Seattle Court of Appeals. We have one case in front of us today. That's Mr. Asuncolo or Dr. Asuncolo versus the Board of Medical Examiners. And our counsel here.
President, on behalf of respondent, Paul Cooper, Your Honor.
Thank you. Thank you. And have you had an opportunity to review the rules and instructions for today's oral argument? Okay, then I won't belabor the point and go over those any longer. I would just remind those that are in the audience and everyone else, if you have a pager or a cell phone or anything else that might go off, to please turn it off now. And just to remind everybody that the case is being recorded and will make its way to the World Wide Web in the next day or two or three. So keep that in mind if you have anything that you think is of a more sensitive or confidential nature. With that said, I believe we're ready to get started then.
May it please the court, I would like to reserve, can I reserve just 3 minutes instead of five?
We'll do the best we can to remind you at the 3 minute mark, and the bailiff can wave to me if, I haven't caught that either. Proceed.
The defense theory at the hearing was that Dr. Asuncolo was targeted for revocation before the hearing even began. In such a case, the presumption of regularity would not apply, and the matter in this case was prejudged before the hearing took place. Even though we were unable to get discovery of the board minutes in executive session or to get testimony of Susan Miller, the executive director of the board, we were able to establish the following facts at the hearing. Number one, none of the 15 patients whose care was questioned had filed a complaint against Dr. Asuncolo. None of the 15 patients had suffered a bad or poor outcome from his care. None of the 15 patients were even contacted by the board to see what they thought of Dr. Asuncolo's care. And in fact, two of Dr. Asuncolo's patients did testify on his behalf. The charges were repetitive and duplicitous. There were basically 70 malpractice cases consolidated into this one hearing by having multiple allegations of violations against on the same patient. This is calculated to make it financially impossible for a doctor to defend himself in front of the board. Many doctors have to go along with stipulations or sanctions because they can't afford to spend the immense amounts of money that are eaten up in defending their cases. They had attempted a summary suspension of Dr. Asuncolo in 2005. And after that hearing, they were unable to sustain the summary suspension. But within about 3 weeks of losing the summary suspension, they filed the 30-day letter, which formed the basis of these complaints. The charts, the medical charts that were utilized for the 30-day letter and for this case, were charts that were obtained from Dr. Asuncolo's monitoring while he was under a board stipulation. And they often will have a doctor go under a stipulation and then use things that occurred during the course of the stipulation. Susan Miller, who had been the executive director of the board for many years, had attended both panels meetings and the full board meetings, including executive sessions. The administrative law judge would not allow me to question the board's motives and conduct. He made that clear in the pre-hearing conference. And he made it very clear again during the first day of the hearing when the Attorney General's office, despite his ruling in the pre-hearing conference, attempted to introduce testimony on the theory that it went to my to rebut my defense of targeting of the defendant. And Judge Spencer made it clear that was not going to be permitted as a defense. The reason I mention that is they have asserted a waiver because at one point during the pre-hearing conference after lengthy argument, Judge Spencer said that the case should turn on the medical care, and I said I agree. I did not waive his objections of targeting, which were filed in our answer, maintained throughout the pendency of the case and in our exceptions, and as I said, until the pre-hearing conference when he said we could not prove that up.
Mr. Cooper, let me ask you a question.
Sure.
Under Rule 103, this court is not permitted to review that the exclusion of evidence as error unless you preserved it as by making an offer of proof. Did you do so before the ALJ?
No. I didn't have any discovery of that information. And the only thing he said that I could do was introduce evidence that she influenced an expert witness rather than the board's conduct.
Well, since that wasn't preserved by an offer of proof, how do we get around the statement in Rule 103 that we may not review it?
Well, that's just one part of our issue of prejudgment, Your Honor.
You're not alleging that the ALJ prejudged the case.
Yes.
You are alleging that the ALJ prejudged.
We believe that if we had discovery, we could prove that. He did not take any notes during the cross-examination of the board's expert or during the testimony of my expert, and he did not make any reference to the testimony of my expert.
Where in your opening brief do you allege bias or prejudice on the part of the ALJ?
We don't specifically allege it. We allege that the entirety of the proceedings resulted in our client being prejudged and having his license revoked.
So you're not arguing that the ALJ was biased or prejudiced against your client?
I am by the conduct that I just referred to, but we did not have, obviously, how do you prove that?
You didn't argue it in your brief, did you?
Well, we didn't make it a separate point in the brief, no.
When you say targeting, that the board targeted him.
Yes.
Are you alleging something like akin to selective prosecution, you know, based on invidious discriminatory factors? Or are you saying that, no, they targeted me because they may have grounds to prosecute me, but...
No, we're saying that they targeted him. And again, every time you try to get the board minutes, everything is decided in executive session. They charged him, they referred the case to the Attorney General in October of 2007 for revocation. That was before CPEP had even had the telephone conversation on November 2nd that led CPEP to conclude that Dr. Asuncillo had not complied with their order. They had already decided the case when that referral was made.
They had decided to pursue a case. They hadn't decided how the case would come out, though, had they?
They referred it for revocation.
Yeah, they referred it for a revocation action.
Well,
so the Attorney General cannot unilaterally decide to revoke, can he?
No, it was the board that referred it to for revocation. He was charged with a mental disability without any evidence of it. Dr. Gunderson testified at the hearing that he did not have it. The final report by CPEP was not even issued until January 31st, 2007. The records underlying the CPEP report were destroyed and never produced. They objected to a continuance of the hearing to comply with recommendations that CPHP made and that Dr. Gunderson discussed. And they objected on the grounds that it would be a waste of time because there would be no settlement in this case. And they told the administrative law judge that there would be no settlement no matter what Dr. Gunderson found in following up on her recommendation as to how to approach Dr. Asuncillo, who was not computer literate, and she had an alternative way of measuring his medical ability that would have obfuscated perhaps the need for the hearing. when the inquiry panel therefore referred the action for revocation, it did so in violation of its own order that said that the CPEP instructions were to be part of the order, and those instructions at that point still said called for Dr. Asuncio to be further evaluated, and it wasn't until November 2nd that the decision was made not to evaluate him further. The final report that was issued by CPEP was different than Joan Neighbor's evaluation, and there was no explanation as to who provided the information for the final report, who made the medical conclusions contained therein, and there was no cross-examination because the case proceeded with just the report being introduced over our objection with all kinds of expert opinions in it and no but one to cross-examine who knew anything about the contents of the report.
Well, two authors signed the summary, didn't they, at the back of it?
I'm sorry, I didn't.
Two authors signed the back of it, didn't they, of the summary report?
Yes, and one of them testified and did not, she was not even a doctor. The one, Dr. Ashbaugh, who was a doctor, was out of the state, was not present, and in fact, before the hearing, they called me. I had scheduled her deposition because she'd been listed as a witness. They called me up and said, we're not going to have her testify. Do you still want her deposition? And they didn't say anything about planning on using her report, or I don't know if it's if those are her conclusions or not. There was no identification of whose expert conclusions they were, and there was no neutral and detached decision maker as required by the DeKoven case. The AG's statement to the court about having no settlement authority from the board and therefore no reason to continue the case to see if it could be resolved through further actions is on pages 7 and 8 of the pre-hearing transcript. I even said on page 11, how can we say what the board will do if they haven't heard this evidence yet? Despite that, the evidence was not permitted and the board was, and the case was not continued and it went forward. Under Tepley, two dispositive facts were, I think, clearly prejudged. The issue of the fact that they were going to keep going till they got Dr. Asuncio, i.e., that he had violated the Medical Practice Act, and the punishment. Even in criminal cases, after a defendant is convicted, the judge will review a pre-sentence report to see what is the appropriate punishment. In this case, the board had already decided before the pre-hearing conference that they were going to revoke Dr. Asuncio no matter what any such pre-hearing evidence or the hearing itself showed in the way of evidence. Thank you. I'd like to reserve.
Okay.
Unless you have questions.
I do have one question.
Sure.
Let's say you're right. Let's say that they did target him, but the evidence justifies taking his license. What's the remedy?
Well, a new hearing with us having discovery to show that so that we can effectively deal with it and impeach it and...
No. Let's assume it. Let's just say we stipulate, you know, we wanted to target this individual, but he does not deserve to practice medicine anymore because of the violations.
Well, but you can't judge that until there's been a fair hearing.
Isn't there a difference between a prosecutorial arm of the board, which was the inquiry panel, and the decision-making arm of the board?
In theory, but they told the judge at the pre-hearing conference that the board would not consider settlement. That's right in the transcript.
Thank you.
Thank you.
From the pre-trial conference, you're saying?
Okay, thank you, Mr. Question.
Oh, okay. Well, I'll get it back later. Counsel, you have 2 minutes and 26 seconds. I stopped the clock halfway through his question. Give you a little more time. Go ahead.
Oh, I'm sorry. May it please the court, I'm Karen McGovern, Assistant Attorney General, registration number 32140. I appear today on behalf of the Board of Medical Examiners. My intent is to respond to Dr. Sunsilo's arguments presented this afternoon. Time permitting, I'd also like to address the issue of substandard care and sanctions as raised in the briefs. Of course, I welcome any questions that you have, and to the extent I don't touch on any of the issues raised on appeal, I'd like to rest on our brief. I'd like to start by making a few corrections to Dr. Sunsilo's argument this afternoon. Dr. Sunsilo argues that he was unable to get the board minutes through discovery. The record clearly reflects that he was given those minutes. That's in the pre-hearing conference transcript, where Dr. Sunsilo says, of course I got the minutes, but I didn't find them to be helpful. He also stated this afternoon that he was unable to get Susan Miller. The record reflects that upon his request to the ALJ to have a board representative of his choosings, attendance and testimony compelled at hearing, that was granted by the ALJ. And Dr. Sunsilo specifically chose Susan Miller, who's the healthcare section director at DORA currently and was the prior program director for the Board of Medical Examiners. The record will reflect that he chose not to call Ms. Miller and instead asked the panel for a stipulation, something to the effect of the panel sends out a 30-day before they retain an expert in a case. The panel didn't stipulate to its admissibility, but did stipulate to that fact, and Dr. Sunsilo chose not to call Ms. Miller. Dr. Sunsilo this afternoon said there was no bad outcome of patient care. The findings of fact in the initial decision, which were adopted by the hearings panel, show that there were several patients, at least three patients, who suffered actual organ damage as a result of poor care of their diabetes. And I would submit to their court that that's a bad outcome.
Ms. McGovern, let me ask you a question. The CPEP report that is the admission of which is contested here, was that submitted solely to show the fact that Dr. Osunsolo was terminated from that program, or was it used for other purposes?
Your Honor, the CPEP report was offered and admitted under the business record exception as evidence that Dr. Sunsilo did not timely or successfully complete the CPEP education program pursuant to the valid board order. That was made clear at the time of admission. It also, the record reflects that that's exactly what the ALJ used the evidence for. And if you would look at, I can point you to the volume, and specifically it's during the testimony of Joan Neighbors, one of Dr. Sunsilo's witnesses, and that's found in volume 8, tab 7, and I apologize, I don't have the exact page, but it is in that volume, in that tab. The ALJ specifically says, I admitted the report to look at whether or not Dr. Sunsilo completed the CPAP program. It has no bearing on the care of the other 15 patients charged.
About in the ALJ's ruling, did the ALJ avoid referring to the report for purposes of the other violations?
That's absolutely correct, Your Honor. If you look at the initial decision, there are two places that specifically talk about the CPAP report. One is during the ALJ's exhaustive analysis of whether or not he completed the program. And then at the end, there's miscellaneous findings. And he does talk about there that there was a disconnect between Dr. Sunsilo's witness, Dr. Joan Neighbors, and the final report of CPAP, although he did not find that showed he didn't complete the program. And in one point he said, her testimony seems to differ a little from the board's expert on the standard of care regarding what Dr. Sunsilo was doing during this time period. But he found that the board's expert on standard of care to be more persuasive, and he specifically set that out. I would like to point out for the court as well is that to the extent the actual care rendered during the CPAP program was discussed, that was at Dr. Osunsolo's own bringing and when he brought in the preceptor to challenge the report. And then through that witness, he got into the actual care that happened during that time. So in staying with the CPAP issue, since that's where we are, the proper foundation was laid for admission as a business record, and that's not disputed by Dr. Sunsilo. His issue seems to be that he does not believe that 8036 contemplates admitting records with expert opinion. And I would state that Rule 8036, by its plain language, specifically contemplates that opinion testimony is admissible. Now, the Colorado Supreme Court interpreted this rule under Schmutz versus Bowles. And I think that that case is very similar to this case. In Schmutz, the Supreme Court found that a report containing an investigator's opinion regarding the causation of a drill malfunction was admissible as a business record exception. In his reply brief, Dr. Sunslow argues that the Supreme Court did not say he was an expert investigator. However, if you look at the facts of the case, the investigator was not present when the drill malfunctioned and therefore had no personal knowledge. Instead, he went back retrospectively and looked at incident reports and conducted interviews. And based on the data that he analyzed, he opined as to the causation. He necessarily needed his technical and scientific knowledge to opine as to the causation. And that squarely puts him as an expert under 702. And that's what we have here. While there's an argument to be made that one wouldn't have to be an expert to decide whether or not Dr. Sunslow met the five objectives that were set forth, it stands to reason that in a program educating a physician, that the physician does the analysis, and therefore they need to use their training and skill. And so I think under this court's analysis under People v. Stewart, it is an expert opinion. But I think that Schmutz versus Bowles says that expert opinion is fine under 8036.
Well, Ms. McGovern, was there testimony or other evidence aside from the CPEP report admitted to show substandard care?
Well, I think I want to make sure I understand your question. It seems like there's sort of two issues. There was substandard care as it relates to the 15 patients that were charged.
Mm-hmm.
But there was also other evidence that Dr. Sunslow did not complete the CPAP program.
Okay. So what I'm trying to determine is, as to the 15 patients, was mm-hmm. there testimony or other evidence
there
submitted on the standard of care with respect to that without relying on the CPAP
yes.
report?
And let me just clarify, to the extent it's not clear. Dr. Sunslow engaged in the CPAP program, and during that program, his preceptors and the CPAP doctors reviewed his care of patients of charts that he turned into them. The 15 patients that are charged in the formal complaint were none of those patients. They had nothing to do with the CPAP program. These were 15 patients that the board identified from Dr. Sunslow's patient care logs that he was required to keep during his probationary term. They were looked at by an independent expert, Dr. Tillman Farley, and he opined as to the standard of care and whether or not he felt that Dr. Sunslow's care met that standard.
Okay. So as to compliance with the CPEP program, the ALJ and the witnesses, I guess, went behind the fact of the report itself and did look at the substantive conclusions in the CPEP report because those were brought up at the hearing?
They did, Your Honor. Essentially, the report came in as a business record exception to show that he didn't complete the program. And the ultimate conclusion of the report is, these are the five objectives, and here are the objectives he didn't meet. During his defense, Dr. Sunslow called his preceptor, Dr. Joe Neighbors. I can't infer the intent, although from being at the trial and from the transcript, it looks as though she was called to discredit the report. During the direct examination and extensively during the cross-examination, we talked about Dr. Sunslow's progress through that report, which included the care of those patients. What I will tell you is that when they offered Dr. Neighbors as a witness, they also offered 18 months worth of her reports where she detailed his care on every case that she reviewed, and that was admitted by Dr. Sunslow. So during the cross-examination, then the panel's attorney did go through and say, that's right, you did say he did well in these areas, but here are the other areas where you said he didn't complete the program. And that was the extent of that. If this court were to find that the CPAP report came in, it shouldn't have come in under 8036, I'd ask this court to consider their holding in People versus Dunlap, which is cited in actually in the appellant's brief. But basically, this court has held that in the context of a bench trial, the effect of improperly admitted evidence is presumed innocuous. And the court's judgment will only be disturbed if it's clear that the court could not have reached the result but for the incompetent evidence. Here, there is substantial evidentiary support in the record, aside from the CPAP report, that demonstrates that Dr. Sunslow did not complete the program. Notably, Elizabeth Kerenick, a signatory to the report, testified that he did not complete the program. His own witness, Dr. Joan Neighbors, testified that, in her opinion, he did not successfully complete the program. And Exhibit 60, which was admitted as a business record from the CPAP program, was admitted without objection by Dr. Osunsolo. And it says specifically, expressly, Dr. Osunsolo did not successfully complete the CPAP program. I want to briefly touch on Dr. Osunsolo's argument that he was unable to rebut the presumption. And the court did touch on this during his argument. Essentially, there's no record for this court to review. There was no offer of proof made. The narrow ruling by the ALJ precluded the board's motives or inquiry panel A's motives for bringing the case to hearing. I'd submit to you that that ruling did not deprive Dr. Osunsolo of due process. It ensured due process.
What about the argument that the entire proceedings was flawed by the board's resistance to any attempt to settle, and as it would have colored or tainted the ALJ and the hearing panel's determination in the case?
The board, inquiry panel A, and sometimes I think we sort of use them interchangeably, but inquiry panel A was the prosecutorial panel, if you will. Inquiry panel A has had a long history with Dr. Osunsolo. And the letter of admonition in 1994 for substandard care, 1995, I'm sorry. A letter of admonition in 1999 for substandard care involving two patients. In 2004, they entered into a stipulation in an attempt to rehabilitate him. There were several patients that received substandard care there, and the board attempted to send him through the physician health program, a remedial education program, practice monitoring, and board oversight. And despite that, the board was faced with 15 patients. And at the time that the formal complaint was charged, there were over 70 issues of substandard care. The board had determined that the inquiry panel had determined that public protection demanded that we proceed towards revocation.
Is it clear from the record that that's what's meant when it says the board is not interested in settlement?
That is correct.
That's what it refers to as the inquiry panel?
It is, Your Honor. And it's clear that at the time of the hearing, I appeared representing Inquiry Panel A. And if you look every time when the record is made that we are representing Inquiry Panel A. And the statutes and laws are such that I can't represent the hearings panel. So I don't speak for the hearings panel. Secondly, the hearings panel is not convened until after there's an initial decision. And at this point, we're at the pretrial conference. The hearings panel has made no determinations. They've not been convened for the purpose of looking at the case.
So is it common to use the word board and inquiry panel A as interchangeable?
It is, Your Honor. I would say that typically as the attorneys, we try to make it specific, but with regards to the ALJ and usually defense counsel, it's used interchangeably. In sum, what we're looking at here is a situation that, despite a lengthy disciplinary history, despite the board's attempts to rehabilitate a physician, we're looking at a case with over 40 instances of substandard care involving 14 patients. Substandard care that wasn't just limited to a single type of patient or a single type of illness. It posed a significant risk to those patients. And in some cases caused actual organ damage, kidneys, eyes, nerves in the hands and the feet. Despite a remedial education plan designed to improve his practice, Dr. Osunsolo cannot conform his practice to meet the generally accepted standards, not the gold standards, the level of minimum competence. As such, the Board of Medical Examiners respectfully request that you uphold the final or affirm the final agency decision of December 20th, 2007, revoking Dr. Osunsulo's license to practice medicine.
Counsel, I'm going to give you another minute like I gave your counterpart. I have a question for you. What if the argument, I never did hear it from your counterpart specifically, but what if the argument is that the motive is improper because it reaches toward national origin or something? And the argument would go further that even if there were violations, they ordinarily would not revoke for those exact same violations. Why wouldn't they be allowed to establish motive to see if they can establish that kind of a motive?
Well, I think I started to address this and I probably neglected to complete my thought, but the inquiry panel and the hearings panel are mandatorily, statutorily separated. And that is not to deprive someone of due process, it's to ensure due process. Because what we have here is we have a fair and impartial fact finder who has no knowledge of what the prosecutorial arm thought or didn't think. They look only at the facts that were properly admitted under the rules of evidence, and make a determination. So if inquiry panel A did have an improper motive, conceding for just for the sake of argument here, hearings panel B and the ALJ certainly didn't know about it, and they still came to the same conclusion, and that's due process.
Well, let's take a little look at that a little bit further, because in the criminal context, you may be prosecuting somebody who may well, under the evidence, be guilty. But if there is a claim of selective prosecution, which is pursued and accepted, then the verdict will be tossed out, even though it would have been a fair and impartial fact finder with that verdict. If it's a selective prosecution, in other words, prosecution based on invidious discriminatory grounds, then they may not allow that particular conviction to stand. Why wouldn't an analogous result apply in a civil context?
I think hypothetically, it may apply if there was proof that there was an invidious reason. What we have here is the ALJ ruled on a blanket allegation of targeting. And I think that when the ALJ makes a ruling, it's incumbent upon the proponent of the evidence to make sure that the person making the ruling knows what they're ruling on. And if that were the claim, then that should have been made clear. And then perhaps it would have been proper.
So in other words, there was no allegation of any invidious discriminatory ground as the basis of an improper motive for pursuing Dr. Osunsulo.
Correct. There was a blanket allegation that Dr. Osunsulo was being targeted.
Thank you.
Thank you.
I would like to respond to a couple of things. Judge Terry, the reason I wanted to ask Susan Miller questions about the motives and the board membership was to see how many people that were on the panel that found that Dr. Osunsulo could not be summarily suspended might have been on this inquiry panel, or how many of them were on the hearing panel. Dr. Osunsulo has been in front of the board for many years. There was no way to tell that without Susan Miller is the one who attends the meetings of panel A, panel B, and the joint board. The members of the board only attend half, but the information can flow through the go-between. What I said in the hearing was that the minutes of the meetings are not informative because they don't say anything. All they say is the panel met and referred the case to the Attorney General's office for, in this case, revocation.
Mr. Cooper, was there any indication that any member of the inquiry panel participated as the hearing panel?
I don't know. I mean, I don't think so. They normally, once on this particular case, but he had just been in front of them on another case 3 weeks before this case got filed. And what I couldn't find out was whether there was any commonality between members in that case.
Well, what I'm trying to, what comes to mind for a judge is that if you, it's not grounds for disqualification of a judge if you happen to know facts because you've been dealing with a particular party before, and even if that may color your knowledge in a way but doesn't necessarily bias you. Help me out with that, because it seems sort of an analogous situation.
Well, as we pointed out in the brief, Ned Kalange, who was the president of the board when we had the summary suspension, kicked my client out and berated us for contacting the Mexican consulate, complaining of the treatment Dr. Asuncio got by the medical board.
Now, how does that indicate bias against your client? It certainly indicates that he wasn't too happy with you, but...
Well, okay. But we were acting on behalf of our client, and he seemed very angry and red-faced and yelling at us. The last thing, if I could have 1 second, on the Schmutz case, the issue is not an expert. That's my case. The issue was 400 FDA reports that were admitted to show that the product, that the manufacturer knew the product was defective. The people who reported it were everybody from a janitor in a hospital setting to somebody else. It wasn't, so the interpretation that was placed on that, I think, was misplaced. I think that the reports in the Schmutz case were admitted factually to show knowledge of the product defect, not to show expert testimony, because they were non-experts, turning them in for the most part. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel, for your excellent arguments. The case will stand submitted, and an opinion will issue in due course. That will do it.